You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 161 by Rudolf Steiner, 13 lectures, translated by Rory Bradley, entitled Artistic Sensitivity as a Spiritual Approach to Knowing Life in the World. This is Lecture 12, given in Dornach on May 1, 1915. There has been one essential feature that has been a part of all the conversations that we have been having recently. This essential feature has been the expression of the fact that we can observe the necessity for a new impulse in human culture at this moment in evolution, that is, the impulse of spiritual knowledge. What these lectures should have demonstrated from a wide variety of vantage points is that a certain period of time has passed that had a particular character, and a new age must now begin. The age that has now passed was one characterized by the most intensely materialistic ways of thinking and feeling, one in which materialistic thinking and feeling gained ever more ground in the inner life of the human soul. But just as a pendulum that has swung all the way out to one side, then has to swing back in the other direction toward the other side, so too we now stand at the beginning of an age in which the human soul must be seized by the sense that spiritual impulses and spiritual forces are hidden throughout the sensory and material world. And spiritual science is to carry forth the knowledge and experience of these spiritual forces that lie behind the sensory and material appearances and events. The spiritual forces that for centuries humanity has paid little attention to and taken little interest in. We all know that nowadays, if you assert that it is possible for the human soul to step into the spiritual worlds, you will be denigrated and called a heretic. We are aware that a wide variety of life factors, consciously or unconsciously, turn against the rise of a stream such as the spiritual scientific one. You might think that at this moment, what spiritual science has to offer about the arrangement and regulation of life and its circumstances seems completely absurd, foolish, and fantastical. But if you take a look at what certain individuals, I would say wiser individuals, have accomplished out of a basic life impulse, then the things spiritual science describes look altogether different. I would first like to draw your attention to the fact that wiser individuals of the present are not completely closed off to what spiritual science wants to accomplish. Even if they are closed off to spiritual science itself, they are not necessarily closed off to what spiritual science wants to achieve. There are many, many examples of this that could be offered. Today I want to offer a characteristic example related to a fairly significant philosopher of recent memory, the recently deceased Otto Liebmann. Most of you will not know the name Otto Liebmann, and that does not matter. But I would say that Otto Liebmann is one of the most perceptive dissectors of human thought life in the recent past. He made inroads from many angles into what we might call the theory of cognition by consistently posing the question, quote, what can human thought comprehend of reality? Close quote. I would like to read for you a short passage from the philosophical writings of Otto Liebmann, because it is characteristic of a man who spent his entire life really working to understand the basis of human thought, and what the present moment might be able to say about it, by really building upon all of the scientific knowledge that had been gained. Otto Liebmann said that someone might hit upon the idea that within an egg there was not only egg white and yolk, but also an unseen spirit. This spirit would then materialize. And when it was finished materializing, it would break the eggshell with the tip of its beak, run over to the grains, and peck at them. At first, he says, might occur to someone that a spirit was in the egg, and once the eggshell was cracked, the spirit would come out and pick at the grain. How would others respond? That is, those who were coming from a perspective that was trying to build a world view out of contemporary science. They would say, quote, if someone says that there is a spirit living inside of an egg, then that person is a fool, close quote. That is what these clever folks would say now. It is precisely what they do to those who call themselves theosophists or anthroposophists. But what does the philosopher who has worked so hard to dissect human thought have to say? He says, quote, the only objection that one could raise to this claim is that the proposition in is nonsense, because it is being used in a physical sense. In a metaphysical sense, it is entirely correct. It is entirely correct that we can do nothing with the imagination that a spirit is physically within the egg. But we understand it metaphysically. Then there can be no objection. It is simply an unusual use of the preposition. Close quote. So the fact is that this philosopher, who wrote two intelligent books titled Analysis der Wirklichkeit, Analysis of Reality, and titled Gedanken und Tatsache, Thought and Facts, wrote in the second volume of titled Naturerkenntnis, Knowledge of Nature, a passage about this invisible spirit, in which he admits that one can stand at the apex of current philosophy and still cannot help but admit that an invisible spirit may indeed be hiding there within the egg. Of course, Otto Liebmann would never deign to see that there is anything reasonable about spiritual science. You might ask, why not? Why would he, or someone who thought like he did, turn toward spiritual science, take a good look at it, and realize that it essentially seeks to do nothing other than assert that in reality this invisible spirit is really there, within the egg. The names really do not matter. We would call it the etheric body, that is then replaced later by the astral body. The spiritual scientist also describes what is found within the egg as an invisible spirit. So the spiritual scientist would really say nothing different from the other man that Liebmann describes. But it is not so easy to make the turn to spiritual science. It is berated as foolish and fantastical, despite the fact that its perspective is being energetically defended by those working on contemporary science and theories of cognition. Is it so different from saying that an invisible spirit is within the egg to claim that in the physical human body, anatomy and physiology are the only concerns of the physical scientists, there is also something hidden and invisible? And if you want to get beyond using the preposition in, and this is indeed important to the philosopher, then you point to something spiritual science says, that this invisible spirit consists of the etheric body, the astral body, and the I, capital. It can be easily shown that spiritual science does not actually do anything that is not truly demanded by all the thinking and cultural processes of the present. Of course, the spiritual scientist needs to go somewhat farther, because it cannot simply be satisfied with a vague sense that there is an invisible spirit in the egg. particularly when it comes to talking about human beings. In that case, we must be clear that the invisible components of the human being have certain characteristics and certain inner qualities of reality. When it comes to an egg, you can have a sort of a spectral imagination of it. Quote, there is a spirit in there, close quote. But when you start talking about human beings, you must be clear that the human being develops consciousness while it resides within a human body. And it develops consciousness precisely because the physical body is such a complicated apparatus. In this, you get a sense that the invisible spirit referred to must count as something that lies at the very foundation of the visible. If the external body has consciousness, then it goes without saying that you must assume that the inner body has consciousness as well, and that you cannot think of it as unconscious. Science would then ask us to see this supposition of spiritual science in such a way as to say that within the physical body there is a spiritual human being, and the nature of this inner being's consciousness is precisely what spiritual science is directed at. We now know, and have known for a long time, what answer to give regarding the exact characteristics of this invisible spirit that underlies the human being. If we first take up the current philosophical perspectives, then we will again find ourselves admitting that an invisible spirit underlies the human being. Now, we ask ourselves, can we know something about this invisible spirit? Indeed, just as the human being gains knowledge of the external world through sense perceptions and through the thoughts that are connected with the brain, this knowledge of the invisible being can be taken further, for within that spirit live our imaginations, and what we have here described as an imaginative knowledge. It is possible to see that an invisible spirit resides not only in the egg, rather the etheric body resides within the human being. This is written about already in my books. And when the etheric body is given the correct opportunity, it is possible for it to separate from the physical body and develop imaginative knowledge, a knowledge that works in and on the imaginations of the world, and that appears before the soul in the form of this moving imagination. Now the question must be posed, what is the real reason that spiritual science has so many opponents now, despite the fact that in essence these same people, who do not even understand themselves, arrive at and talk about the same things that spiritual science says? My dear friends, in regard to this, something must be said that is, shall we say, dangerous to say, or at the very least, it is not lacking in danger to say. Why would Otto Liebmann, if he had a spiritual scientific book in his hand, doubtless say something like, quote, this is too foolish for me, close quote, even though he himself would be standing before the gates of the spiritual world? Why did he live in this strange state of self-denial, in which he stood before those gates? But when somebody came to him and tried to open them for him, he would say, quote, no, I am not going in, close quote. Why? It is not particularly rational. Sometimes we can achieve something through comparisons, and so I would like to answer this question with a comparison. Why are there people among the best individuals of the present who are so afraid of spiritual science? I would like to draw your attention to something that we have already spoken about, that is about what I said about sleep and fatigue. Currently, people are talking a good bit about why human beings have to sleep, and people simply say that they must sleep because they are fatigued. In other words, fatigue is seen as the cause for sleep. This is how many people are talking now. Now, everyone knows from everyday experience in life that fatigue is not the only cause for sleep. Let us say an independently wealthy man comes out of courtesy to some nice lecture, and often barely after the beginning of the lecture he immediately falls asleep, even though he is not tired. From this we all can conclude that fatigue is not the only cause for sleep. Quite the contrary, we would express the truth of the situation more properly if we did not say, quote, "we sleep because we are fatigued," close quote, but rather said, quote, "we feel fatigued because we want to go to sleep," close quote. That would be the more proper way of expressing it. The essence of sleeping is really that human beings, by separating the I and the astral body from the physical and etheric bodies, can then enjoy, or we might even say digest, the physical and etheric bodies from without. When human beings are fully within the physical and etheric bodies, then we live consciously in the external world. Pay close attention to what is being said here. If the I and astral body are outside of the physical and etheric bodies, then we direct all of our will and desires toward the physical and etheric bodies, and we enjoy and digest them from without. When we are within the physical and etheric bodies, it is the external world that makes impressions on us. Now, everything in the world is based around the principle of periodicity, just like a pendulum. When the pendulum reaches a certain high point on one side, then it swings back down, and then it reaches the same height on the opposite side through the force of motion that it gained by swinging down. Just as the pendulum can go only so far before it has to go back and rise up to the other side, so too are sleeping and waking set at opposite poles from one another. This is perhaps the crudest way in which to explain it. Let us assume that during the period between waking and sleeping, we took an interest in the external world and what was happening in it. Doing so was like what happens when the pendulum swings out to one side. If we have engaged pleasurably with the external world, then we eventually become satiated with the external world, and the normal need arises to enjoy ourselves, to engage with ourselves in the same pleasurable way with which we have just engaged with the world. We fall asleep. And once we have derived sufficient enjoyment of ourselves, then we can wake up again. This is a back-and-forth process, a periodicity that runs quite regularly, as a machine does in the external world. But Ahriman and Lucifer can take the human being out of this very natural process. And so, when a person goes to a lecture out of courtesy, and not because he really wants to listen, he can depart from it and redirect his interest. He departs and enjoys himself, because he finds himself more interesting than what is happening in the world around him. So you can see that the person who falls asleep at an abnormal time simply has no interest in his surroundings, in what is happening in the world around him. Nothing different is going on with the kinds of individuals I was just speaking of, who gesture toward the things that spiritual science has to offer. When it comes to spiritual science, Otto Liebmann is like a man who goes to a concert or a lecture out of courtesy and then promptly falls asleep. He goes but does not actually want to take up what is being offered there. We can say the same thing in a more elevated style about men like Otto Liebmann. They come to philosophy, to the land of the spirit, through connections that exist in our world. They write a dissertation and a book, and then are sent to be teachers at an upper school. They prove themselves to be good thinkers and are sent to the university. The whole philosophical endeavor is just a disguised form of worldly courtesy. It is courtesy one need not feel inwardly called to the land of spirit. They go to the gates, they go in, and they fall asleep. Not immediately, like the independently wealthy man who is taken to a concert and falls asleep even if he is not tired. They fall asleep because there is a lack of interesting things to engage the object consciousness, and they cannot awaken into imaginative consciousness. If you are not able to awaken into imaginative consciousness, then you fall asleep the very moment that someone starts to talk about the spiritual world. In other words, it is just too difficult for people to take up spiritual science. And therefore, it is not altogether safe to say such things, because then people start saying to you, quote, "Ah, so you are the ones who keep talking about things that are so difficult and onerous for other people, for other important people," close quote. But the fact that we are aware of the difficulty does not exactly make us proud or haughty. We do know, however, that what we have to take up together will be railed against by the world, because people do not want to engage with such complicated things, precisely because those things are too difficult for them. Let us now take a closer look at the difficulties that present themselves. We will start to get at them by asking the question, what comprises the normal thought process for human beings between waking and sleeping? What makes it up? Now, a crudely materialistic thinker will tell you that thinking happens because the human being has a brain with an incredibly intricate structure, that processes happen within this brain, and that a thought arises because these processes are happening. Thinking is a result of brain processes, he will tell you. I have already drawn your attention to the fact that saying this is equivalent to saying, quote, "I crossed the street. There are footprints and tire tracks there. Where did these tire tracks come from?" Well, the earth below must have made them. The earth itself created those footprints and tire tracks, close quote. The person who thinks the brain itself is able to produce such thoughts is working on the same logical level. It is exactly the same thing as a person walking across the street, seeing all sorts of tracks and saying, quote, "Aha, this must be the earth's doing, the earth which is filled with all sorts of intricate forces that then produce these tracks," close quote. This is the same thing as having a physiologist come forward and look at the human brain and see the many processes happening there and say, quote, "All of that is the product of the brain," close quote. The tracks that crisscross the surface of the earth are not created by the earth itself, but rather by the people and the cars that move across its surface. And neither are the processes that the anatomist and physiologist have discovered created by the brain, but rather by the forces that move within the etheric body. Here we arrive at the fallacy of materialism. There is nothing in daily life that does not make an impression upon the brain. Just as every step makes an impression on the earth, and just as you could prove that every one of your steps makes an impression on the earth, so too could you prove that everything that is wished and thought makes an impression and has an effect upon the brain. But this is only the footprint, as it were, that is left behind by the thought itself. The thought actually comes from the etheric body, and in reality, everything that you experience as thought is nothing other than the inner activity of the etheric body. For as long as we are in our physical bodies, we need the physical body for thinking. And this is why it is actually very easy to see why materialists do not arrive at the truth. The materialist says, for God's sake, there you admit that you have to have a brain, or otherwise you cannot think. And so you must also see that the brain actually does the thinking, close quote. But this conclusion is only as clever as it would be to say the following, quote, I can prove to you that the print you see on the ground there was made by the ground itself. I will remove a section of the ground, and then you will see that you cannot go anywhere without it. Close quote. The ground is necessary. In the same way, it is necessary that we have a brain, so that we can think while we are within our physical bodies. It is necessary to become clear about these things, because it is how we learn to recognize the falsehoods under which the thinking of the present suffers. To recognize the full sum of incorrect things with which our thinking misleads itself. And also, to recognize that we must heal these problems by engaging with that complicated form of knowing that does not take the physical body into consideration. When we move in our physical bodies, we must have a ground beneath our feet. When we think in the physical world, we must have some sort of counterpoint as a kind of ground for this thinking, namely the nervous system. But if we are able to shift the work of thinking back into our astral bodies, then our etheric bodies will become, for our astral bodies, what our physical bodies are when we think in the etheric body. If we move into imaginative thinking, then we are thinking with the astral body, and the etheric body then contains the footprints or traces, just as the physical body contains the footprints or traces of thinking when it is carried out in the etheric body. And once we are outside of the physical body, after death, and have also cast off our etheric bodies, as I have often described to you in the past, then our counterpoint is the external etheric life force. Then we are inscribing into the actual cosmos what the astral body and later the I will develop. This is the process that we undergo during what is called the first stage of initiation. This process is the one in which we shift our thinking. Parenthesis, it is not thinking anymore, but the activity of thought is retained, close parenthesis, from the etheric body back into the astral body. We give over the task of keeping the footprints or traces of this thought activity, which had previously been held by the physical body, to the etheric body. This is the essence of the first step of initiation. The shift of the activity previously carried out by the etheric body onto the astral body. Thus we see that when we are living in imaginative knowledge, we pull back to a certain extent from the physical body and retreat to the etheric body, thereby leaving no further traces upon the physical body. And so it happens that, for those who have undergone the first stage of initiation, this physical body from which they have retreated becomes objective, since it now exists for them external to their astral body and I. Before, they existed solely within that physical body. Now, it exists external to them. They think, feel, and will totally in the astral body. They influence the etheric body and leave traces there. But they no longer influence the physical body and see it now as something external. This is generally the normal course of the first stage of initiation. It expresses itself somewhat differently in each person's subjective experience. Now, I would like to use a sort of schematic drawing to make this first stage of initiation clear to you, and there's a drawing. Let us say that this is the human head, and then we have the etheric body surrounding that head. When the human being begins to develop in the way I have just described, then the etheric body grows like this. And the thing to note here is that this parallels the occurrence that we call the blooming of the lotus flower. Excuse me, of the lotus blossom. The human being grows etherically, as it were, out of itself. And the thing to note here is that by growing etherically out of itself, the human being also develops something outside of the body that we might call a kind of etheric heart. As physical human beings, we have a physical heart. We all know how to evaluate the difference between a dry, abstract man who thinks like a real machine and a one who really has his heart in everything he does and experiences, meaning, of course, the physical heart. We can all tell the difference between such people. We do not expect that the dry, skulking person who does not really have his heart in anything that he does or experiences has much real knowledge about the physical plane. In parallel to the experiences that I described in title How to Know Higher Worlds, a kind of spiritual heart, external to the physical body, takes form. Just as the circulatory system forms in the body with the heart at its center. This network stretches outside the body, and then we start to feel connected in a heartfelt way with everything that we learn to know and recognize through spiritual science. We simply must not demand that a person have the heart within the body in something related to spiritual science. Instead, the person must be in it with the heart that exists outside of the body, with that heart, really come to spiritual knowledge fully. When you read through a piece of spiritual scientific writing, it is certainly possible to say, quote, "This is all just dry. It is science. I really have to study and learn this. I already have to study and learn enough in my life, and now I have to study everything spiritual science says as well. There is no heart in that." Close quote. You will find the heart in it if you simply immerse yourself in the material deeply enough. To be sure, many people say, quote, "Ah, theosophy must simply be nothing more than saying that people need to become one with the world through the eye," close quote. Becoming one, developing the God within the individual, and discovering the divine eye are popular phrases, well loved by those who want to be theosophists or who want to know something about theosophy. All of this comes from the fact that people do not want to get involved in developing a warmth of heart even after they are no longer supported by the life warmth of the physical heart. Lichtenberg said, quote, "When a head and a book collide and there is a hollow sound, the book is not to blame," close quote. We could also say that when a person encounters spiritual science and finds no warmth of heart in it, spiritual science is not to blame. Everything that I have described as the normal path to clairvoyance consists in the human beings lifting the etheric body, and indeed all of the other higher aspects of the organism, out of the physical body and developing a heart external to the physical body. So, what about normal everyday thinking? You see, an everyday thought is developed within the etheric body. But then it encounters the physical body and makes impressions all over the brain. If you want to bring before your soul the essence of everyday thinking, you could say that in everyday thinking, you think in the etheric body, and the thoughts fall onto the nervous system of the brain where they make impressions. But these impressions do not go deep, and they echo back. And this is how thinking is reflected. And in this reflection, it becomes conscious. So thinking is really a process in which we have a thought already in our souls on the level of the etheric body. It makes an impression on the physical brain, but cannot penetrate it and has to come back. This returning thought is what we then perceive. And this is where the physiologists come in and show us the footprints and traces left by the thought on the physical brain. What would happen if this thought were not to return, but rather go into the brain and generate processes there? If it did not return, then we would not perceive it. It would simply move into the brain and initiate processes. It is possible to imagine that the thought might not return, but would instead remain in the brain. Then we would have no consciousness, for consciousness comes about only in the moment when the thought is reflected back. But there is an activity of the soul that goes into the physical body in this way, the will. The will is differentiated from thinking in that thinking is reflected by the physical organism and then its reflection is perceived, but the will is not. In the case of the will, it moves into the physical organism and then calls up a physical process there. This results in our moving our hands or something like that. The will comes about very differently than the thought. The thought comes about precisely because it is reflected. The will, on the other hand, moves into the physical organism and is not reflected. Rather, it initiates certain processes within the physical organism. Now, in another part of our bodily organism, it is possible that something like this, which is actually moved into the body, nevertheless is returned. Follow carefully what I am about to say. In using our brains to think, things proceed so that the thought activity begins in the etheric brain, is bounced onto the physical nervous system, and thereby comes to the level of consciousness. When we move into clairvoyance, we push thinking back a little bit. We think with the astral body, and the thought is thrown back by the etheric body. Here, and there's a drawing, number one on the left, is the external world, and here is the physical body, in the case of thinking with the brain. Here, in the case of a clairvoyant individual, is the external world, which we then work upon with the astral body, see drawing two on the right side. The etheric body throws back what the astral body generates, and the physical body is excluded from the whole process. Here, referring to drawing one, when we will something, the soul activity moves fully into the physical body. When we move or shift a hand, it is the soul that does this. But its activity must bring about inner organic material processes, and in these processes, the soul activity is brought to completion. I would like to say it this way. In the case of the will, the soul activity expires in the material activity of the body. Now, ask yourself, quote, how do we actually live when we live in our thinking? Close quote. In our thinking, we live very near to the boundary of eternity. In the moment that we exclude the physical body and allow our thoughts to be reflected by the etheric body, we are living within everything that we carry with us through the gate of death. On the other hand, for as long as we allow our thoughts to be reflected by the physical body, we are living in what we have between birth and death. But when we will something, our will belongs completely to the physical body. Our physical body is there to complete the activity of our will. Whereas thinking stands right before the gates of eternity, the will is intended solely for the physical body. Remember what I said in one of the earlier lectures. The will is an infant, and when it gets older, it becomes thinking. This accords with what we might say today from another vantage point. The will is bound up in temporality, and only by having the human being continue to evolve and become wiser and wiser, filling the will ever more with thinking, shall what is born into the will be elevated out of temporality and into the eternal, freed from the body. But in a part of the body, something else is active. The underlying nervous system, the system of ganglia, the nervous system of the stomach, the solar plexus is often counted as a part of this same system. As it currently develops within the human being, this nervous system is an incomplete organ. It is present only in its very first initial form. Later, it will develop further. But just as we know that a child is able to develop some of the characteristics that can also be developed as an adult, so too can we know that this nervous system, which currently serves to attend to organic activity, will also develop further. This nervous system, which runs in conjunction with the actual brain and spinal column, and nearly all of the nerves that extend into the various limbs, this nervous system in the torso and stomach is not yet so developed as to be able to do the things that it will be able to do once we are living on Jupiter. There the brain and spinal cord will have regressed somewhat, and the nervous system of the torso and stomach will have a completely different formation than it currently has. At that point, it will extend across the surface of the human being. For everything that is at first within the human being will later be laid across the surface. As a result, for everyday life between birth and death, we do not make direct use of this nervous system, but rather allow it to remain in the unconscious. But then, it can happen, under abnormal circumstances, that what lies in the will and the appetitive faculty goes into the human organism and then, again under abnormal conditions that we will discuss, gets thrown back from the stomach nervous system, just as the thought is thrown back by the brain. The will moves into the ganglia system, but then, instead of turning into activity, it gets thrown back by the ganglia, and something happens within the human being that normally only happens in the brain. A process begins that can be described as follows. When you look at the transition from our normal waking consciousness to a state of clairvoyance, you can see how, in the normal nervous system, our thoughts, feelings, and will are reflected. The feelings and will only insofar as they are thoughts. But otherwise, the things that are a part of the will are allowed to move completely into the physical organism. But in the state of clairvoyance, we also develop, outside of the physical body, as it were, a higher form of organ as a kind of counterpart to the brain. Just as the everyday brain is connected with the physical heart, so too is the thinking organ that develops outside in the astral body connected with the etheric heart. This is a higher form of clairvoyance, head clairvoyance. But a human being can also go in the other direction. You can move into the organization with what exists with that, in quotes, infant will, in such a way that the will becomes thinking, even though one normally goes from thinking to will. This is the deeper foundation for what I mentioned some time ago as the difference between head clairvoyance and stomach clairvoyance. In head clairvoyance, a new etheric organ is formed through which one becomes independent of the physical organism. In stomach clairvoyance, you call upon the ganglia system to something that is normally unseen and unconsidered. This is why the experiences of stomach clairvoyance are more fleeting than our normal experiences when waking. They have no meaning for the soul after it is moved through the gate of death. Everything that is gained through head clairvoyance has a lasting spiritual significance, even for the soul after it has moved through the gate of death. Indeed, it has more significance than one's experiences in daily waking life. The things that are gained through stomach clairvoyance have even less significance than the knowledge of everyday waking life for the life after death. That somnambulant clairvoyance has a lower, not higher, position than waking everyday consciousness. This is not to say that all sorts of poetic and other characteristics cannot be developed through stomach clairvoyance, because in the moment that stomach clairvoyance begins, it is really the ganglia and not the will that are inserted into the physical body. As a result, the activity of the etheric body is held up in the ganglia and then streams back, and you become aware of things that you cannot become aware of through your brain. You can perceive thoughts that cannot be perceived through the brain, but there is still a subordinate activity at work. So you see, we can make a sharp distinction between head and stomach clairvoyance. Now you might ask, quote, "How can I tell whether I am developing stomach or head clairvoyance?" Close quote. I can only tell you that head clairvoyance will develop only when we seek it through the ways in which it comes to us through meditation and concentration, and when we fully develop everything that we receive on the paths of meditation and concentration. Stomach clairvoyance does not come about through meditation and concentration. Stomach clairvoyance happens when we perceive the ganglia system, and this happens only because of certain abnormal conditions that arise in life. It is more comfortable to be someone with stomach clairvoyance because in a certain sense it happens automatically, whereas head clairvoyance must be earned through great effort. This is why it is best not to say, when clairvoyance seems to arise automatically, that those who have this gift that they have not worked for but must be graced by God. It is actually best to be somewhat skeptical in these situations. It is possible to show a number of examples of ways in which stomach clairvoyance can come about. The only way that head clairvoyance can come about is that those who work regularly and diligently through meditation and concentration bring themselves to a certain stage of an initiation process. In regard to stomach clairvoyance, I would like to present one of the most harmless ways in which one can become a stomach clairvoyant, for it is not exactly safe to speak about such things. Let us assume that a man grows up under conditions that lead him to develop an early desire to become a, quotes, in quotes, great man in the external physical world, like these privy counselors, civil servants, and heads of state that are out there. In other words, let us assume that he develops early on the desire to become a privy counselor or hold some other position in the administration. Having such a desire means that one is ambitious. This ambition lives in his desires. It can really burn there, quite terribly, in fact. The person becomes clear with himself, quote, "You will become a privy counselor," close quote. But his desire burns him, and he goes through the world with this burning desire, and he grows up with it. And so it happens that his desire does not always move regularly into the physical organization. Something is disrupted. If that man were to become a privy counselor, then he would not become a stomach clairvoyant. If he wants to become a privy counselor but does not become one, and moves through the world with this burning desire which eats at him and eats at him, then he can become a stomach clairvoyant. but this desire must be very strong. Since there is no one here among us who wants to become a privy counselor, I can safely say all of this. When this desire eats away at someone, it sticks in the physical organism, and the ganglia system will start to throw back these desires. And it is possible that the person becomes a stomach clairvoyant through these reflected desires. Then, perhaps, for example, the man lives in Berlin at 25 Schönhauser Allee, and his neighbor who lives at 23 Schönhauser Allee actually becomes a privy counselor. It is possible that he might perceive this event through a particularly well-formed stomach clairvoyance. This has to do with the fact that his ganglia system becomes particularly sensitive by the internalized desire to become a privy counselor. And if the other man becomes something else in a similar vein, then he might be able to develop a very sensitive and intense clairvoyance for such things as well. This kind of clairvoyance normally develops in regard to something in particular. Since you know that there are other desires in life than the somewhat harmless ones that I just mentioned, you can see how these other desires would lead to different forms and particularities for this kind of clairvoyance. They flow into the physical organism because they remained unfulfilled in life, even though they continue to exist. And so you see the kinds of desires that lead to the incitement of stomach clairvoyance. It is always incited by desires, even if the people who have it do not always recognize it. In the burning desires that are reflected, events are also reflected that can then be perceived by the etheric body. Now you can more clearly see the differentiation between head and stomach clairvoyance. We need this because it is connected with what I will be talking about in more detail tomorrow, the end of Lecture 12.